leaving no one behind. This online talk series is titled Leaving No One Behind, and it is brought to you by the House of African Feminisms, which is a Goethe Institute project in Southern Africa. In this series of talk, we seek to explore intersectionality in African feminism. To all of you joining us, welcome everybody. On this Africa Women's Day, 31st of July, which is a day that was instituted by the Pan-African Women Association, created in 1962, and the day was instituted in 1974, to recognize and to affirm the role of women's organizing in achieving the political freedom of Africa and advancing the social and economic status of women on the continent. And it is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Wumpini Fatimata Mohammed. I'm going to call you Dr. Mohammed sometimes because, you know, you've earned that doctorate of yours. you need to call the doctor.
My mom would be happy to hear that.
Yeah, you see, before we get into our conversation, Dr. Mohammed, you are a professor and a feminist activist scholar. Your research focuses on feminisms, social movement, decolonization, and media. You are the co-editor with Dr. Msia Kibona Clark of the book African Women in Digital Spaces, Redefining Social Movements on the Continent and in the Diaspora. The book was published in 2023. Wumpini, what are the structures you think that, you know, created this significant number of African women in digital spaces?
Of course, you cannot talk about digital media and digital spaces without discussing the digital divide. So the fact that there are more and more African women and Africans in general in digital spaces does not take away from the fact that there are also a lot of African women and African people who are not in digital spaces. And I think this is one of the points that we make in the book, right? I like to make a comparison between digital spaces and how they displace the notion of borders and boundaries, right? So before Africa was colonized, the notion of borders were not really part of our discourses or our imaginary, right? And so, you know, we had like the Ewe people or the Ashanti people, the Wala or the Dagaba people. And today we have the Dagaba in Burkina Faso. And in Ghana, we have the Ashanti in Cote d'Ivoire. And in Ghana, we have the Owe in Togo and in Ghana. So I think that what digital spaces have done have been to, in a way, sort of take us back to these times when borders were not really an issue and when Africans sort of the relationship between Africans and the land or even spaces were sort of different. And I think right now, even as we talk about digital spaces, the growth in access to digital media is the result, is the reason why we have more and more of us online. And as we talk about African women in digital spaces, it's important for us to even look at what this looks like. So I'll say that majority of Africans are on Facebook, because I'll say that Facebook is, it's one of the older social media platforms, and it's a little bit more intuitive than platforms such as Twitter. And then we're also seeing a little bit of a shift where there are more and more African young people on TikTok platforms. And I think one of the things that TikTok as a platform has done and WhatsApp too as platforms have done have been to create, to build in affordances for people who are not literate in colonial languages like French and English and Spanish to be able to participate. So sometimes I use my auntie as an example who is not literate in English. Every morning I get like a good morning visual from her with like a cup of coffee and it says good morning. So I'll send a voice note in response and that's how we communicate. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about African women in digital spaces, it's not just the women who went to university, women who went to school. There are also women who are on these platforms who are using them in ways that the affordances allow them to. And these digital spaces have sort of decentralized access to the public sphere. Mm-hmm. So not just the national public sphere, but also the continental public sphere where Africans can gather and have, it's sort of like reminiscent of the village square, right? In the village where you would gather and have conversations and talk about, you know, village politics, village gossip, whatever was going on. So that's what we are seeing in the digital spaces. And in its initial stages in the digital spaces, we're seeing that they were sort of exclusionary, like I said, of the most marginalized in our communities. But now some of them have the affordances, again, like TikTok and WhatsApp, for the most marginalized of us to participate in these conversations.
You know, it's very interesting what you said about your aunt because recently my brother, who lives in the US, set up a WhatsApp group and with the whole family. There is English in that group, French, Yakuba, some Jula, like there is everything going. And for nieces and nephews who do not speak any of those languages, some of us are like, doing, translations and that sort of thing. So, and that creates closeness. One of the things that jumped out to me also was the intersectionality as we, join, with this social movement in a movement like Black Lives Matter movement, and we had to have the hashtag say her name. Otherwise, Black Lives was very much male, so-called male dominated, or closer to home here in Senegal, where we had the Yanama movement. Then you go online, you're like, oh yeah, obviously the women are there. Obviously the women are organizing. Obviously it is the women, the women are also on the street and some of them are. So I just want to be talking about the textures that all of these, whether it is our family WhatsApp group, but the hashtag movement or Facebook has brought to all of these social movement.
One of the things that I have noticed, especially with social movements, so historically, when we've talked about, let's say, feminist movements or the movements for liberation, the people who end up writing the stories or the narratives about these movements are usually people in very, very privileged positions from dominant identities, whether dominant ethnic groups, dominant genders, like very dominant identities. And I think what social media or digital media has done has been to bring attention to these silenced narratives or erased perspectives in these conversations. So I'm just going to take Ghana as an example. Ghana's independence liberation movement, a lot of the narratives around that, of course, center men. And then when they talk about women, they are women from specific ethnicities, right? Or women from specific regions. And then we see that women who constituted the masses or women who did not go to school, who equally contributed, maybe even by funding the liberation, like for example, market women funding liberation movements. You just say market women funded the liberation movement, but you don't know who specifically were these women. You don't see them named. Or they'll say women supported the independence movement in Africa or in Ghana, but you don't know which women, right? So what these digital spaces have done have been to create the space for me personally, as someone from a marginalized ethnic group, religion, region of Ghana, to be able to participate in discourses in the public sphere and to draw attention to these topics and identities and how they are erased. I actually did a paper, I think it was published last year, on intersectionality and digital organizing in Ghana, where I was talking about how when we do activism in Ghana, and my critique of social movements in Ghana was basically that there were certain social movements in their bid to reach out to the masses of Ghanaians. We're doing work in indigenous languages, which is amazing, which is something that I have always pushed for. But then there was the erasure of the entire half of the country, the northern half of the country, where no northern languages were represented. One of the things that I brought up was the fact that when we do this type of organizing, let's think about what languages have been marginalized, what communities have been marginalized in the national public sphere, even if the nation or state institutions have participated in this erasure. Social movements should disrupt this sort of erasure, should move away from what state institutions have done, and then pay attention more to bringing these silenced narratives to the mainstream or to the forefront so that these conversations can be had. As we talk about, social movements, I'm really impressed by the growth that I'm seeing on Facebook because in organizing spaces, we have often thought of Facebook as a conservative platform. And I think that it's important to move away from that and to see how people are using Facebook in radical ways. So there are Facebook groups dedicated to women in Ghana, Nigeria, all of these African countries, where women come and ask questions, women do mutual aid, support each other. Or even when someone is an abusive, emotionally abusive relationship, other women will point it out and be like, you should probably get a divorce, right? So we are seeing these conversations being had in spaces that you ordinarily would not really pay attention to, or in spaces that have sort of been framed as conservative spaces.
One of the things I really enjoyed about the book, actually, you know, speaking of dominant identities, in this book, we have academic essays, we have creative nonfictions, poetry. So that's one of the dominant narratives. You didn't do like your typical academic book.
We were trying to redefine what knowledge is for academics. In my community, we know what knowledge is. We know how we build knowledge. We know how knowledge is transmitted from generation to generation. But in academia, the notion around knowledge is you have to speak in language that is, you have to use big, big grammar. And if your language is accessible, it means that you are not advancing a smart argument. And you know, sometimes I have people reach out to me and say, I really like your work because it's accessible. And then they have to add, especially when they're academic, they have to add that, oh, and I don't mean that as an insult. Because in academia, people think that when anyone at all can take your book and read, or your paper and read it and understand, it means you are not smart enough. So a lot of the times when regular people tell me they enjoy my work, they don't say, I was able to read it. They don't say, oh, and that's, I mean it as a comment. They don't have to add that. We basically wanted to demystify what constitutes knowledge, because people create knowledge. It's not just, academics are just a tiny fraction of the people who create knowledge. And people were creating knowledge before, university, higher education was invented, right? We're creating knowledge in our communities, and we still create knowledge. And I actually do a lot more of this in my paper called Bilshinsi Philosophy, where I talk about African philosophies like Bilshinsi, Ubuntu, and how there are places where we can learn more about knowledge, African knowledges and African philosophies and African ideologies, and what we can use, how we can use them as theories in producing research. And in this book, we're interested in amplifying erased voices. And when we say that, we mean that we're trying to look at what are the perspectives that we often do not see in collections such as these. And a lot of collections will often, when they do a collection on African feminist organizing, it means Anglo-African. Even when they say Anglo-African, they mean Ghana, Nigeria, South Africa, maybe
yes.
Kenya. Uganda would be lucky to be a part of it. So this is Anglo. And then we don't even, Equatorial Guinea is not even on the map.
Oh,
like,
no.
It's not on the map of this, whatever we are doing, right? And so one of the things that I was really interested in was that we wanted to create a book or a collection that was truly African and truly African diasporic. And so we're also thinking about, you know, as far as knowledge is concerned, defying colonial borders and divisions, and how they have created the notion of Anglophone Africa or Francophone or Hispanophone or Lusophone Africa, right? Because, you know, when you take away the colonial inflections to identities, there is so much more that we have in common. So it was really interesting to see the different flavors of coloniality or colonialism and how they shaped women's experiences in these countries and the connections, right? So in defying colonial borders too, we're also looking at the way that African activists or feminists were speaking to one another and learning from one another. So it's really interesting working on this to see, for example, how the feminist coalition in Nigeria, basically, I think I saw online on Twitter somewhere where people were like, this coalition has been more accountable to Nigerians than any Nigerian government has ever been accountable to. And it was because they basically had an accounting of the funds and where the funds were used and all of that. So those are some of the things that we're interested in looking at, demystifying knowledge, defying colonial borders, and also sort of amplifying erased voices in these movements.
Yeah, I mean, like when I saw the name of Fabienne Kano, I was like, wow, she even, or Nora Egyecha, who is from Martinique also. I mean, those are countries that you do not, well, see in so-called Anglophone publication, and vice versa also.
One of the things that I was so happy about with the collection was the fact that 99% of the collections were African, Black African. And I'm so very proud of that, because a lot of the times academics will write work, academics will do work and you're like, you are a white French woman writing about Togo. Can you tell us how your identity shaped the way that you write about it? So it was good to see people speak for themselves and not be spoken for by others.
Yeah, no, that is, I love the letter that Fabienne Kano wrote, Autopsy of a Black Woman, and, you know, linking it to her own mother coming to France and, you know, telling her to go out to ensure that she always uses a handkerchief when she goes out. whether it is to wipe away tears, whether, you know, all of those little things. And of course, Fabienne Cano is a huge intellectual. And her remembering the death of Vore, that woman that nobody knew about. I want to talk about knowledge. And in this book, it was very interesting to see how forgotten, erased practices of knowledge were used by some of the activists. I think of Dr. Stella Nyanzi in Uganda. Shout out to Uganda. And you yourself, you know, you engage in a lot of public shaming online. Let's talk about that, how this reclaiming of knowledge has been done. I don't want to use the word indigenous.
In the book, one of the chapters by Mumbi, a Kenyan feminist, where she talks about the politics of disrespectability, is amazing. So right now, no, this is not just an African problem. This is a global problem that post-colonial societies have to deal with, where there's a lot of respectability around a lot of things. And one of the things that we are seeing current feminists on the continent and beyond do is to pull from our communities and to sort of, you know, some of the strategies, people think that they are coming up with them fresh. And I'm like, I mean, it's not exactly a new idea. It's not novel. It's not a novel concept. So what Stella Nyanzi did with her nude protest in Uganda is something, for example, that we know that market women in Ghana would utilize. So, for example, let's say if there were like really high taxes or the economy was terrible, even the threat of like a nude protest would get the people responsible right back on track. And so an example of this disrespectability, we can go to Nigeria and take the example of sitting on a man, which is the notion in a particular community where if men were shirking their duties as, you know, fathers to their children or husbands to their wives, they would come up with mechanisms to shame them into behaving properly. And in my own community in Ghana, in among the Dagwamba in Ghana, for example, if a man was shirking his duties as a father to his children, not supporting the family in the ways that he was supposed to, women would compose songs at the riverside. And at the, so if you went to the riverside, you'd hear the song. You went to the market, you'd hear it everywhere. And people would be like, oh, he's an irresponsible father. Because a lot of the time people say, feminism is a Western concept. And I'm like, well, I mean, if you want to say the word, sure, but like we did have feminist values in some of our communities, and there were feminist women in our communities who did all of these things. Mm-hmm. So if you want to look at feminists from an African perspective, you can always find it, even if the women did not identify as feminists, because historically feminism was exclusionary of African, Black women, women of color. Yeah, sure, I get it. But it doesn't mean that the values espoused in that have been taken away or from our communities. So in Ghana, we are talking about feminism and feminist activism or the matrix of oppression. A lot of people just say, oh, feminism, women. But I feel like in the African context, and it's the argument that I make in some of my other papers, just focusing on the woman category is a very narrow way of thinking about feminism, because it looks at oppression and marginalization, whether you're a woman or you're a man, right? So a working class man might be marginalized in ways that a middle class woman is not.
And the way we actually also have gender today on this continent, like the binary system, this is very colonial also. I am very aware that, you know, I have so many questions. Somebody is asking where they can access this book.
I wanted it to be accessible or available on the continent, but it looks like right now it's mostly available in East Africa and also online via ebook format. But we're trying to get work again with a West African publisher so that it will be available, because we thought it was going to be, you know, going with an African publisher meant there would be continental distribution. But again, you know, colonial hurdles.
The borders are dreadful. Yeah. But I was able to get it in an ebook format online. It was easy enough to get it. And the people were really helpful in getting you to access the book. So that's one thing. But yeah, I mean, it is good that you are going to check like different publishers. And I do want to know what informs your activism. You are from Tamale. You speak about Dagbani culture. I hope I've said that right. Your next paper is going to be heavily focused on that. I'm looking forward to be reading that. What nourishes your activism?
When you grow up in a household, when you're growing up in your household, you assume what is normal to you is normal to other people. And so you go out and you're like, oh, they do it differently in their house than what we do in our house. So, you know, growing up in a space where you understand what it means to be marginalized, you learn. So I knew that I was marginalized even before I went to the south of Ghana to get an education. I mean, I knew I was marginalized, but I didn't really feel it. But I did learn about it before I went to college, right? And then when I did go to college, of course, I learned about it from my parents, you know, basically talking about, oh, certain people in Ghana are treated a particular way because of their ethnic identity or because of their religion or because of, and these were conversations, normal everyday conversations that we had at home. We have debates and arguments about all of these issues every day. Right now, when I think back on it, I'm beginning to realize that my dad was sort of an activist in some way, in the ways that he approached life and the way he saw things, even today. And so going to the South and becoming a minority and feeling it, you know, having the knowledge about being marginalized within the nation state and then feeling, experiencing, they are two different things. I mean, knowledge is like intellectualizing it, and then you experience it in your face every day about how you are othered and you are not, you know, you're othered, you're not centered, you're marginal, you're supposed to stay at the margins because you
In
don't speak
your own country.
in your own country, right? Because you don't speak. I think that's what sort of drives my activism, right? And so a lot of my intellectual work and my activist work has been to write my community back into Ghanaian histories in the form of documented knowledge. And when I say documented knowledge, in the form of written, so it doesn't mean that we don't have it. It's there. Like in my community, we know that these are the things that we did, right? But it's oral, right? So my work sort of complements these oral knowledges that we already know exist. But we live in a space and in an era where if something is not documented, people generally don't value it. It comes with this colonial sort of mindset.
Exactly. Some questions. I am curious about how digital feminist activism decenters neoliberal ways of organizing that centers individual outside of their movements.
So I feel like it goes back to the point that you made earlier about the NGOization of feminist movements on the continent, especially. And I feel like there is a lot that we could learn from other parts of the world, like other global South communities in the world. So I've learned a lot living in the US, especially from the organizing of Black communities, where they are not modeled in the form of an NGO. And some of these organizations are not registered because being a registered organization comes with its own baggage,
I
right?
see.
So they do the work with the community volunteers, with the people available. People come in and help here and there as they can. For us, in much of our continent, it's like we need an executive director and then we pay them $5,000 a month. Let's say they get a grant of $100,000 and then $70,000 goes into overhead costs. And then maybe if we're lucky, $30,000 will actually go to the community that they got the $100,000 for. But in other spaces where feminist activism is rooted in community and it has not been like institutionalized in the ways that NGO activism has done.
Abdul Rafi Mohamed is asking, how do we make African books accessible in Africa? Is there a government policy for African literature that we aren't aware of, or there is none?
This question is for you. You should answer this question. You are a writer and you are in the literary space.
I know, Abdul, it is very, very hard. As a writer and as a literary activist, it is a hard thing for me. I mean, do we actually need a government policy, or do we need an African Union policy on this? And talking about the NGOization of, feminist spaces, feminist organizations on a continent, and about maybe the need of thinking grassroots movement, how, they were organized.
Africans who live in Europe and North America and the global north, and who are like professors like me here, when I publish a book, like this book that we published with an African editor, we did it because we were defiant. The university would be like, oh, it's an African publisher. Ooh, it's not going to be very good for your promotion. It has to be an American publisher. So those are some of the structural hurdles that we face. So my book that is going to come out hopefully next year, I have an American publisher to satisfy my job requirements, and I have an African. So it's the same book, but I have an African publisher because I want my mother to be able to go into the market and buy my book.
One last question. What is your take on artificial intelligence and algorithmic bias as it pertains to African women? And what are the implications of this on African women and feminist digital futures? People are
Very
not playing
good.
with you today. Oh.
They are not like ah, I did in the valley say I did not tie my shilorga. I did not tie my, our mothers, they have like the wrapper, then they have like a rope that
Yeah.
they tie around to keep it. I didn't tie it for this conversation, baby.
Well, now you have to try it.
That's a very good question, Emma. I feel like AI right now, we're already seeing the effects of AI in the US, especially within the entertainment media industry, where it is taking away jobs from artists and actors. And, this is something that we talk about in some of my classes, where AI is taking away jobs from mostly people who work at the margins, right? So, like people who do work as extras on a film or people who do all of this kind of work. And I also feel like it has the potential to exploit the intellectual labor of Africans. And African feminists for, I don't know, whatever, for capitalist ends, of course. So I think that the uncritical embrace of AI, we need to be very conscious about or cautious about how we are uncritically embracing AI as this new thing that is going to radically change our lives. And we also have to think about how it's going to affect the most marginalized people in our communities, especially within the labor sector, the people who do the work. I also anticipate that some might think that it would be, I don't know, some people think that it's going to be good for research. I don't believe in that. I'm a very big AI skeptic. Like, I remember last week or so, I was like, I'm tired of hearing about AI. And maybe if Jackie wants to jump in, because Jackie, if you want to jump in and answer this AI question, since you're more, in the digital feminist, digital future space,
Okay,
feel
please do
how to take
jump
it.
in.
I think for me, my take on that specifically would be around the counter work that feminists, that African feminists are doing. I guess where I am currently in my thinking is how to counter the already existing, damage that we're already seeing for us on this other side, specifically around the question of power, which I've seen a couple of African feminists responding to the issue of power imbalance, but also like pointing to how the discourse is sort of binary, like those for the AI and those that are anti-AI and AI does this for everyone, but not necessarily talking about like the capital, like who owns these algorithms of oppression at the end of the day. But also taking it a bit further to the question of resource, specifically the sustainability of, how all these infrastructures are supposed to run. So I think the ways in which the digital futures for African feminism in relation to AI is also a question of, sustainability. It's a question of knowledge management, but also knowledge theft. It's also a question of labor, especially around, the ways in which women's labor is exploited.
No, thank you so much, Jackie. This was really helpful. Thank you so much, Bumpini. This has been great. Keep being brilliant. Thank you so much for being part of this conversation.
Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you. Ciao. Bye-bye.